Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we speak with one of the all-time greats of jazz, Benny Golson, who's coming to town with his quartet tomorrow night at the Oklahoma Jazz Hall of Fame. Golson is a wonderfully inventive tenor saxophonist who grew up jamming with John Coltrane and has performed with all the great jazz musicians of his time. He's been a band leader who's led groups ranging from the classic jazz tet with Art Farmer to his group today. But above all, he's an accomplished composer with at least 8 compositions that are considered jazz standards, like I Remember Clifford, Stablemates, and Killer Joe, to name a few. Golson has spent a number of years composing film and television music. In fact, during the 1970s, Golson's music was heard all over the television, from MASH to Mannix to Mission Impossible to the Mod Squad. That's just the M's. He's still composing today. Here's a sample of his Uptown Afterburn from his latest album from 2009, New Time, New Tet. Of jazz saxophonist Benny Golson, who appears at the Oklahoma Jazz Hall of Fame tomorrow night. He joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Benny Golson, it's my great honor to have you on the program. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much.
You have been very busy the last couple of months. You've been on the road on and off. For those who are hoping to hear you this Friday, tell us a little bit about your band.
Well, we have a newcomer, sort of newcomer, on piano, Sharp Radway. When you look at him, you think about Oscar Peterson because his bulk is so big. I said, boy, you're a big guy. And he plays in a big way, too. And you might remember a mainstay in my career because he used to be with the Jazz Tet, Ray Drummond on bass. You
yes.
might remember that.
Yes,
name.
Oh yeah, he's a great player. Yeah.
And it's going to be to everybody's surprise, I have Wynton Marcellus' youngest brother, Jason Marcellus, is my drummer.
An incredible drummer. Incredible
and,
drummer.
He's got a lot of surprises for you. I told him just last night, when he walks with a kind of a bounce. And I said, boy, if I had that kind of energy now. He's much younger than me, you see.
Yeah, oh yeah. It sounds like a great band. We're looking forward to hearing it. Now, you grew up in Philadelphia at one of those great times, you know, maybe Vienna in the 1800s. Detroit, and Philadelphia is one of those great cities where all these incredible musicians came around at the same time. You know, I know you probably ask all the time, what was in the water, but what do you attribute that? Coltrane was there, the Heath Brothers, Clifford Brown, Philly Joe Jones, Jimmy Smith, Red Rodney, Stan Getz, all from Philadelphia. What was going on in Philadelphia at that time?
Bud Powell, too. Yeah, there are lots of I think it's just a matter of time and unforeseen occurrences. It's something that just happened. There was nothing planned, of course. You know, my being born to my mother living in Philadelphia was not anything planned. It just happened that way. And, Detroit and Philadelphia seem to have been the forerunners in producing a lot of the jazz luminaries.
Was it a matter of there were places to sort of become proficient to experiment?
Was loaded. Yeah. Philadelphia was loaded. And so was Detroit. Yeah, not quite as many places now, unfortunately, but during that time there were. As a matter of fact, John Coltrane and I lived in North Philadelphia. Jimmy Heath was in South Philly. Philly Joe was in West Philly, for example. But in North Philly, most of the clubs were located in North Philadelphia, and the main street was Columbia Avenue, and they were lined with clubs. And John and I used to go to the every Saturday afternoon from 4 to 7 used to be jam session time. And, of course, we couldn't play them all at once. So John and I would start from one end, you know, and the next time go to the next club, cross over the street and come back down the other side as the weeks went by. There were many places then. Then there were a few in South Philadelphia and a couple in West Philadelphia that were notable. But Philadelphia had a plethora of jazz clubs during that time. There was always jazz around.
What's interesting is you spent so much time jamming with Coltrane, and you know, when you think of a geographic center, you know, there's sort of a sound like the Texas tenors. They all sound, you know, they've got that same hard bone sort of tenor sound. Whereas you and Coltrane, after spending so many hours together, you have very different sounds, and each wonderful in their own way. Why do you suppose that was? Was it just the way you hear things, the way he heard things?
You're exactly right. But it didn't start out like that. In the beginning, when John and I hooked up, we used to practice in my living room because we had a house, but he lived in an apartment, so it was more convenient to be in our house in the living room where the record player was, and that was our school, the 78 record. You remember 78 records?
Maybe just barely. Just barely.
Just barely. We used to get those 78 records. They were black, 37 cents for each record. They were black and shiny, you know, the shellac on it, and when we finished, they were dull and gray and looked like it was a rummage sale item because we moved that tone arm back, you know, that played it with the needle in it, back and forth, back and forth. What did he do there? What happened there? Back and forth, back and forth. That was our school, you know, and it was all in my living room. And we were together all the time, you know, and we started going to jam sessions together. But we were eclectic during that time. We didn't have anything upon which we could draw from our own past or career. We had no career. So we had to copy. We had to mimic what we were hearing. But by mimicking, we began to get the feel of what it was, and then we eventually learned to conceptualize, and we developed our own particular sound by what we wanted to do by choice. So it was a thing of evolving into what we became. We didn't come on the scene just getting our instruments and playing like that. I mean, when I started, I was playing alone in my living room, and the neighbors wanted to kill me because it was summertime and they could hear me, you know. And when he joined me, they wanted to kill two people, but we got better.
Of course, on a 78, you only have 3 minutes. So it
that's
was,
right.
When you were learning, when you're learning, it's like, you know, the musicians were, you better say it quick and get out of the way.
See, but the thing is to get an abundance of 78s, Dad, and you're on track.
Yeah. Well, I should also mention a Tulsa connection that you have. One of your first big bands that you played on was the Earl Bostick Band. Earl was born and grew up here in Tulsa.
That's right. Oh, he was a demon. Ooh, that guy. He was the best instrumental saxophone player I ever heard in my life. I'm not talking about style. I'm talking about technique. Charlie Parker, Willie Smith, Johnny Hart, nobody could touch him. Technique, not style. That guy was inhuman, the things that he could do on that saxophone.
And the funny thing is, nobody hearing him will ever really know that unless you heard him in person, because he always had a philosophy of, man, don't play something on a record that somebody will steal. He saved his best licks for live, right?
Look, let me tell you, I'm telling you how great he was, but he rarely showed that when we played. We played the song Flamingo till I was having nightmares about it. I mean, Flamingo. <Yeah. laughs> It's like I think when I hear the word flamingo, and slowly I turn. Yeah, no, people wouldn't get any idea of what he was by hearing him play flamingo. He went far, far, far past that, you know, but he made his money playing flamingo.
Yeah.
Incredible. Lots of guys do that sometimes, you know. But it wasn't the first rhythm and blues band I played with. The first one I played with was a fellow named Bull Moose Jackson, who, yeah, he looked like the sound of his name, but a lovely guy. And he was a tenor saxophone player who used to play with Lucky Milliner's band, and he would sing a few songs. And he had a voice, beautiful voice, you know, and he had a hit song. What was that? I Love You, Yes, I Do. And the women would come to see the guy singing this beautiful song, and when they walked in the club and looked at him, they said, oh, because he looked nothing like the way he sounded. but he was a sweetheart of a guy. And believe it or not, I met Tad Dameron in that band. I couldn't believe that Tad Dameron was the piano player with Bull Moose Jackson and how that happened. They grew up together. And Bull Moose's real name was Benjamin Jackson. They grew up as elementary school students all through school in Cleveland. And in New York, Bull Moose, he wasn't living there at the time, but he was always there because it was buzzing with business, you know. And he ran into Tad, and Tad was at Liberty, which means he wasn't working. And he said, well, look, you're not working. Why don't you come on and make a few gigs with me, and because I need a piano player, and you can leave whenever you get ready. And I came during that time when he was the piano player, and that's how I met him.
You've always said that Tad Dameron had a big influence on all the music that you wrote for the Jazz Ted at the time, because he could make three horns sound so big.
No. Two horns.
Two horns, excuse me.
Yeah. Charlie Rouse and Fats Navarro. Ah, I wonder how he did it. And I picked his brain, and he let me pick it. I learned so much from him in the beginning. Now, by the time I got to the Jazz Ted, I was into something else. But yeah, he set me on track, Tad Dameron. I would write my simple things, and he'd look at me and he said, "Ah, this is horrible. This is wrong. What do you mean here?" You know, I was doing everything wrong.
So you're going to school.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was my first big influence with the writing. Yeah, I was so glad I met him, because he set me on the right course. It might have taken me years before I arrived at where I did, but he was doing it. I remember he was writing arrangements for people. He wrote something for Duke Ellington, and he let me copy it. And as I copied, I could see everything that he was doing. You know, it was like an open, like a road map. Oh, yeah, he was very helpful in my career. And at one point, with tongue in cheek, he was really very proud of me, because we were in the same band. He was writing for Bull Moose. And then I began to write things, too, and he said to me, "You write those arrangements of yours, and at the end of the night, people come up to me and say, 'Ah, that was a great arrangement you did on such and such a Tad, and you did it. What a drag!'" But he was, in his heart, he was so proud of me. He was really laughing about it. Yeah, I was beginning to sound like him, because I didn't know how to sound like anybody else. I didn't have a sound of my own. But eventually, just like with John and I, eventually I began to get the hold of it and get the idea. Then I got a voice of my own.
Finding your own voice, you know, it's not the safe path a lot of times. Was that always the goal, to find your own voice? Or
Intuitively, you're trying to find your own voice. You might not know it. And people think, Benny Golson, he's a fantastic jazz composer. He's written all of these things that people play all over the world. See, but the only reason they think that is because they never heard All Those Dogs I Wrote, you see. If they had heard All Those Dogs I Wrote, they would be so quick to say how great I am.
Well, you certainly have written, there's a songbook. There's a Benny Golson songbook. One of the things that's great about it, Killer Joe, I Remember Clifford, Along Came Betty, Whisper Not, Five Spot After Dark, Blues March. These are played by anybody and everybody. They're universally approachable. And for many performer composers, sometimes that composition becomes completely identified with the composer. And other musicians, you know, it's kind of like, well, do I want to touch that? But your work, everybody wants to play them. Have you ever thought about why?
The only reason I can think, when I began my musical career, and I use career advisedly, I was 9 years old, and I became interested in the piano. Now, during that time, we were poor families, I mean, during that time. But everybody in the black neighborhood, almost everybody, seemed to have a piano in their living room. And nobody knew how to play it. It was a piece of furniture. They had pictures of the family and lace doilies and a bric-a-brac here and there. But nobody played the piano. It was just a piece of furniture. But in my house, my mother's brother and her brother-in-law, my two uncles, played the piano after a fashion. And when they would finish, I would go over to the piano and look, and it was a mystery how they could touch those keys and make the music come out. And so I began to try to learn how to play and pick melodies out, you know, one finger. And my mother noticed it and asked me, did I want to take piano lessons? And I had thought about it, and I said, yeah, and I began to take piano lessons. And as I began to learn how to play the piano, I did that for about 5 years, I got good enough, because I was going at it assiduously. My teacher used to send me out on Sunday afternoons, sometimes when these black bourgeois ladies would have tea parties, and I was the piano player. So really, I was just going there really to practice, because nobody was really listening to me, just like kind of background stuff. But I loved the classic. I loved Brahms, and I loved Chopin. I had a penchant for melodies. So when I started playing the saxophone at 14, and became interested in writing, that penchant showed itself in the things that I was writing that were so-called jazz things, I guess. So those things that I did had a melodic content, things that you could go away humming rather than athleticism. Nobody can hum that, you know. But Whisper Not, Along Came Betty, Blues March, Killer Joe, even staple bass, these things had a melody that you could remember. And I was doing it intuitively because I felt it that way. And that's the only thing I can think of it that made them successful. And as I wrote these things, I had no idea what the future of the thing was going to be. Nobody does. Because the future always tells you by the way the people accept it. Whether they buy the records, if they come to hear you play it, those kinds of things. That makes it successful. If everybody knew that this was going to be successful or that was going to be successful, I could have gotten up one morning and said, well, I think I'll write a couple of hits today. But it doesn't go like that. Well, you know, when I wrote Killer Joe, my wife told me, it'll never make it. It's too monotonous. Blues March, Art Blakey didn't want to record it. I had to talk him into recording. Nobody plays a march in jazz. Are you crazy? The only time you hear marches at funerals in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Well, let's hear one of your greatest hits. This is a Biddy Gulson's great hit, Whisper Not. That's the music of Biddy Gulson, his classic Whisper Not. He's our guest today, jazz saxophonist composer. He'll be playing at the Oklahoma Jazz Hall of Fame Friday night, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, you've written all these great classics, and of course, when you play live, people want to hear them live. Do you ever get tired of playing these songs that have been a part of your life for 50, 60 years, or is it always a new experience?
Sometimes I feel like saying, when they want to hear this or that, and I feel like saying, oh, but I've written this. But when you write things like that, and people want to hear them, that's testimony to who I am and what I do. So I play them, just like I sign autographs. These are the people who make me who I am. Yeah. Without them, I would be nothing. So the public is really, I have a symbiosis with the public. When I play metaphorically, I'm sitting out there in the audience with them, and they're on the stage with me. You'll see if you come to hear me play. I talk a lot. In fact, about a month ago, I played in New York, and now I think I'll continue to use that billing, and they billed me this way. Biddy Gulson, his quartet, and his intriguing stories of the past. And the audience is telling me, gee, we love the stories as much as we do the music. And sometimes I find I'm talking for 5 minutes before I play a song. And everybody's looking at me with bated breath.
Well, you have a lot of stories because you've lived it. You really have.
There are stories. But yeah. I think any musician could do that. Oh, yeah. They have stories. But I've chosen to talk about them.
Yeah. There was about a couple decades where you spent time working in television and film. The television of the early 70s. Biddy Gulson was everywhere, practically.
Yeah.
Now, some musicians, and that was a time when a lot of jazz musicians sort of turned to scoring. The jazz clubs were closing, and it was lucrative. Some musicians loved it. Some musicians really resented the system. You were very successful. Did you like that system? Did you like writing for film and television?
Oh, I loved it. Now, preceding me was Quincy Jones. He went out there. We used to live in the same building. After him, Alvin Nelson went out there. And Leonard, remember Leonard Feather, the critic?
Yes, right. Uh-huh.
He moved out there, and they were giving me phone calls and writing these letters. You got to come out here. And I felt like I was hearing the voice of Horace Greeley, who was saying, go west, young man. So I eventually went out there. That's how I got out there. But before I went out there, I was intrigued with a fellow named Henry Brandt. Now, Henry Brandt was an orchestrator. He was teaching at Bennington up in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the one who orchestrated Cleopatra for Alex North.
Henry Brandt was a great orchestrator. Yeah,
he orchestrated that. He did Spartacus, and he did some other films. So I got with him, and I studied privately with him. Now, after doing that for a while, I used to study with him. He used to come home from Bennington every Sunday. Every Sunday morning, I used to go to his house and study with him. And after a few months of that, I was beginning to understand things that took me beyond the blues, and I got rhythm and things like that. But I had no outlet. You couldn't do an arrangement of Count Basie using the stuff he was teaching me. Something absolutely different. My only outlet was to go to Hollywood, where you could use it in writing for films. Now, and how I got out there, an actor, he was in this film, and Henry was going to orchestrate it. Anyway, he couldn't do it, and he recommended one of his students, who was me. And I went out there to do it, and that's how I got out there, and I liked it so well. After I did that, I came back to New York and moved out there.
Mm.
And that's how I got started into it. And you remember Percy Faith and his orchestra?
Yes, uh-huh.
Well, his son was, he would one who would hire composers, and so he had a...
Music consultant was what you'd call him today, yeah, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so he took me on because he had Quincy, and he had Quincy, and another one had Oliver Nelson, but he took me on, and then he took me out to Universal Studios, and that's how I got started. He got me in that thing out there. And my first thing was, if you remember, a show called It Takes a Thief with Robert Wagner.
Right, right, uh-huh.
Yeah. And then one thing led to another. I went over to Paramount. I started working on Mission Impossible. I went out to what was the other studio? I can't think of it. Doing the Partridge Family, MASH.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say Rupton 222? Then I did some specials, you know.
Mm-hmm.
One thing led to another, and that's how I got into it. And I thought, well, this is going to be it. I put my saxophone down. I didn't play that saxophone for about 7 or 8 years. I figured I'd never play again. This is what I wanted to do. But as things turned out, I got the itch again to play after all that time, and I got back into playing. And I've got completely away from the film writing. But Terrence Blanchard is coming on strong now. He just did Red Tail.
Yeah.
He's coming on very strong. You've got to keep your eye on him. But now I'm doing what I think I was meant to do, just play my saxophone.
My guest today is Benny Golson, a jazz saxophonist and composer. We're talking about film music. One of your more high-profile gigs over the last decade or so was the cameo in the Steven Spielberg film The Terminal, where the Tom Hanks character wants your autograph to complete a set of all the musicians in the famous Art Kane Great Day in Harlem photograph. I wanted to close by asking you what you remember about that day. Art Kane, what did he have to say to get you?
First I've got to tell you, I'm so disappointed I didn't get the Academy Award.
Oh.
Well, the first thing I remember about that picture, Nat Hentoff was the one that, you remember Nat Hentoff?
Yes, a great writer on civil liberties and jazz, yes. Right.
Yeah, but he used to be a jazz writer then.
Yeah.
He's been my friend for many years. He gave me a call and said, would you like to come up and be a part of this picture? And I wondered, nobody knows who the heck Benny Golson is. Why is he calling me? I went up there anyway, and when I went up there, I only knew a couple of the musicians on that picture. Well, after a while, I almost knew all of them. But up there, I was like the new boy in town. And I remember Art Kane, it took him so long to get some of the shots, because when the musicians all got together like that, they hadn't seen each other in a long time. Hey, how's your wife? How old is your kid now? When is the last time you played the gig with someone? When have you been to Greenville, South Carolina? You know, and then there was a bar on the corner. Well,
uh-oh.
Let's go down and have a little toot. And then he was ready to take the picture, and this guy was missing, that guy. They'd come back, and somebody else was missing. it took forever to take that shot. Yeah, I remember it well.
And of course,
the only one I knew then was Dizzy Gillespie, because I was playing in his band then. And Art Farmer, because I was standing next to him. That's right.
You guys were at the very top. You were at the very top of the picture.
Yeah. I was at the very top. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
And now you look at that picture, and I think there are only about five of us left. Sonny Rollins, Mary McPartland, Horace Silver, and there's a drummer, I forgot his name.
Yeah.
There's just about five of us.
Yeah.
Something. Last time I saw Jerry Mulligan, we did a cruise together, and he was ailing then. And for some reason, I don't know what it was, he was sitting down. I went over, hugged him, and kissed him on the cheek. And that was the last time I ever saw him.
Mm.
That was something. Yeah, time does all kinds of things. But there, that's a memorable shot. But when I showed up on that picture, nobody knew who the heck I was.
Now, I understand that when Steven Spielberg approached you, or you know, through his people to your people, you kind of said, "Oh no, I don't want to do that." You thought
exactly.
You thought it was an audition, I guess, right?
No, I'll tell you why. During my lifetime, my career, I used to get calls from advertising agents to show up to possibly be this character or that character. I never got anything from any of those calls. It was like a cattle call. And I would go to them religiously, and nothing ever happened. Then Woody Allen called. I went to that. Nothing happened. Then he called again. I went to that. I didn't get it. Some other saxophone player got it. And then they said, the office called me. I was in Europe. They said, oh, Steven Spielberg, well, it was his office who called, and wanted to know, are you interested in the film A Small Part? And I said, no, because I figured it was going to be the same thing. And then they said, no, he wants you. Now, that was unusual. So I said, well, okay. And then I found out what was involved, and they sent me a little script that I had to go, because he was in Los Angeles, I had to go downtown New York to a studio, and it was like a screen test. And then I said what they wanted me to say, what I would be saying in the film. And they said, oh, fine. But they sort of looked on my face, and they said, well, what is it? I said, well, you know, a musician really wouldn't say it like that. He would say it a little differently. And they said, well, let's do it again, and do it the way you feel. And they did it again. They sent it to him, and he said, that's it. And then that's when I found, and I still didn't know what the film was about. And we had to go to Montreal to shoot it, because that's where he had rented this, it was an airplane hangar, I guess. Mm-hmm. And he built many sets, one of which was the nightclub set, which I was supposed to have been playing in. And look, that's Steven Spielberg. He's a first-class guy. You know what he said to me? He said, we're building this set for you for the nightclub scene. We don't have a piano there. What kind of piano would you like? And I said, a 12-foot Steinway grand. When I got there, it was there. And you know, when musicians usually do something in a film, they give you a trailer. That's a nice trailer. They gave each one of us a trailer, Steven Spielberg, a trailer to kill for. King-size bed, plasma TV, everything you could think of. I said to my wife, because she was with me, I said, wouldn't it be great if we took this trailer back to 96th Street, parked out front of the building and lived in it? I mean, this guy, and time to eat, it's about 400 people he was serving there, you know, because there was a lot of people in the production of this film. Gourmet, I couldn't believe it. And when I first met him, I was in the hotel that we were all in, and his entourage came in, and I said, oh, to my wife, there's Steven Spielberg. And then one of his secretaries got up and came over to my table and said, are you Mr. Golson? I said, yes. She said, oh, Steve would like to speak to you. So I got ready to get up. She said, oh, no, he'll come over. He got up from the group, came over. There was no place for him to sit. He knelt by the table and started talking about his mother. Oh, I'm trying to get my mother out of this delicatessen. You know, she's finished. She won't give it up. Like old friends. I said, Steven, I said, would you stand up a minute? So he stood up, and I stood up. I said, I promised myself, if I ever met you, since you've been my idol for so long, it was something I was going to do. He said, what? I hugged him and kissed him. He fell out. We were friends after that. Incredible. Well, a lovely man. I love that guy. He's so talented.
Well, you're going to hear more stories just like this on Friday, I'm sure, Oklahoma Jazz Hall of Fame, when Benny Golson appears. Benny, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for talking to me.
Benny Golson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be appearing with his quartet at the Oklahoma Jazz Hall of Fame tomorrow night. For information on the concert, visit okjazz.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. You can listen to any of our old programs online at publicradiotulsa.org. Have a great day. I'm Rich Fisher.